This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Bastards of Science, to another crazy episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm Brian. That guy over there is Cargill. Hello, Cargill.
Hi, junkies.
How are you doing, everybody? How are you doing, Cargill?
I'm doing great. I'm doing wonderful.
Did you enjoy your vacation? I know I did. Our week off. Did you go to the beach?
Did I go to the beach?
Did you take it,
you know,
in that
nice week up we took where it rained every day
really
for 9 days?
I think junkies, that much like you, the weather was furious at us for taking a week off and proceeded to pound Austin with a tsunami.
Were junkies mad at us?
No, probably
week?
Not.
I didn't think so.
No. Nobody seemed upset. In fact, we had one person tweet like, "I want to get mad at you, but you guys deserve." And I was like, "Yeah, it's August and we haven't taken a break all summer." And the reason we haven't taken a break all summer is because we've been doing our One Junkie Summer series, highlighting the best, the craziest, the junkiest movies of 1986, of the summer.
We're probably going to be wrapping up soon.
Yeah, we're coming to the end.
I mean, you and I need to sit down with a list and go, okay, what are the not misses?
Yeah.
Because technically, summer goes on until September 21st, right?
That is true.
Technically, it's still summer. And we did start this a little late.
That's true.
We did miss May rather than jumping into movie summer.
That's true. We actually
started at summer. and there's still so much great summer of 86 stuff out there. Like, there's still some cool smaller things to find. There's still a couple of big ones left that we haven't quite dabbled our toes in.
Sure.
But you know, for those of you out there, junkies, if there's a summer of 86 movie that you are absolutely like, you guys cannot get out of the summer without talking about this movie, hit us up on Twitter and let us know that you want us to cover the summer of 86 movie. One of the things I want to do is later this year, I want to cover a couple of the other 86 movies, since we've got some other big 30-year anniversaries coming up in the next few months of some stuff that we really should talk about, and then one or two movies from earlier in the year that we didn't cover because they were beforehand. But I mean, there's still some crazy 1986-ness that should probably be revisited and talked about.
Agreed.
But while we wrap up this wonderful walk down memory lane as we try to ignore the fact that 2016 is happening around us.
Yeah, and if you would like to throw out some of those suggestions to us, you can do so at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter or on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you're a big fan of the show, why not consider going to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and becoming a patron? In addition to helping us keep the lights on here at Junk Food Cinema, you will also receive bonus episodes that only the patrons get to hear.
And we have interactive bonus episodes.
We're doing more mailbags. We just started Junk Food Cinema a la mode, which is where we review movies that are in theaters that we think might be junk food worthy. So there's a lot of cool stuff.
And we've got a movie coming up soon that you and I are super excited for. That's our next a la mode.
I keep
hearing from people who saw it at South by Southwest and at Fright Fest that it's fucking awesome.
I cannot wait for that. But as Cargill mentioned, we are coming to the end of the summer. This series were Gilligan's Island, we are officially at the "and the rest" part of the theme song.
And the rest!
So we are winding down this series, but that is not to take away from some of the movies that are celebrating their 30th anniversary. Just last week, in fact, this particular film celebrated its 30th anniversary.
The king of all body horror, baby!
The king of body horror. The movie, one of the two movies, I think, puts to rest forever the idea that horror remakes can't be great.
Yeah.
I think that's a bullshit generalization, and this is one of the two titans that just completely crushes that notion.
Titans, like, yes. Absolute titans. And you know what? We should probably do an episode, for the patrons, just counting down the greatest horror remakes of all time, because
yeah.
I know your list will probably have Nightmare on Elm Street, for which you will never be able to live down.
No, it won't, because of that goddamn third act cop out. It's so close to making that list, and then it was just like, nope, never
mind. But there are so many great horror remakes, and sure, this is one of the best.
And we're, of course, talking about 1986 David Cronenberg's The Fly.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Help me. Help me.
I gotta say this about the original. That scene at the end still gives me nightmares. Like, I know it was made in 1958, but that fucking scene and that voice and that everything about that scene gives me nightmares. But there's not a lot throughout the rest of that movie that I would really consider scary. It's a well enough made movie, but this film is one of those examples to me of the perfect filmmaker with the perfect project getting to bring together the dream team of collaborators that he always works with, and then creating something that should not be. Much like our hero creating something that should not be, and that is a completely gross-out body horror, graphic horror movie that is also heartbreakingly emotional, has heartbreaking emotional depth to it.
Yeah.
And that's what The Fly is.
This is Cronenberg at the height of his powers.
Yes.
Like, this is one of the, yeah, I love that you say it's a film that should not be. It is a film that should not be. Like, on paper, you know, what is it? Well, it's a story with pretty much only three characters who go back and forth between a handful of different rooms, and something bad happens in it. And that's, you know, that's it. Like, there is, you know, everything else is character building, but there's not a lot to this movie.
Plot-wise, yes.
Plot-wise.
Yeah.
It just is a great fucking story, and it's three really interesting characters, and really only like a handful of other speaking characters throughout the rest of the movie.
There's three characters and then a smattering of featured extras, more than there are even other characters in this movie. There's three. I mean, it is very,
I'd argue that the barfly is almost a character.
Almost a character. But it is very theatrical in that way. Like, you could totally see this as a stage production. And in fact, in 2008, I didn't know this, I found this out during research, was turned into a two-act opera directed by Cronenberg.
Opera?
Yeah, and the music was done by Howard Shore, who is, of course, his longtime composer collaborator. He did the music for The Fly, which takes a lot of, actually, which makes sense in a way, because a lot of the musical cues in the movie The Fly are taken from Madame Butterfly, which is an opera. So it's kind of this weird cyclical thing, the idea of bringing it to the stage as an opera, which is a little odd, but I could totally see this as a play, because, like you said, it's a very self-contained set of sets. It's a very A to B type of plot. In fact, almost literally, you're teleported from A to B. And there's not a lot going on in terms of the story structure, but there is so much going on in terms of character and in terms of just the relationships between people, and using science fiction in my favorite way, which is to use science to get at the heart of what makes us human, and doing that in a really gruesome way, juxtaposing that against watching a human become a non-human to emphasize what makes us human. That's fucking brilliant to me.
And it's so fucking gross.
Oh, no, it's
holy
gross.
Shit. Is there a...
It is so gross.
Is there a movie that is well known that is more that is considerably mainstream that is grosser than this?
I can only think of one that comes close, and I'm not even sure I would put this in the same category as far as mainstream appeal, and that would be The Other Titan, that I consider the buster of the notion that remakes can't be great. And that's the thing. Yeah,
yeah. And the thing's gross. It's not as gross as this, but it's close. Wow. I would.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, it is gross. Don't get me wrong. But like, the regurgitation scene in this, when he's eating food, then the regurgitation scene on you know, on the other guy,
yes.
Whose name I always forget.
On John Getz, who plays Stathis, who is Stathis. Not a Game of Thrones character somehow.
Yeah, but, well, it is Baratheon.
Stathis Baratheon. His cousin, Stathis Baratheon.
Stathis the Mathis.
His name is actually Stathis Borans in this movie, which sounds so close to Stannis Baratheon. That is crazy.
But yeah, no, there's some, and of course, this has probably, like, you think about the dog scene in The Thing.
Yeah.
This kind of ratcheted that up. Because keep in mind, this is 4 years after The Thing. It's like, oh, yeah, you think that? Watch what we do to an orangutan. Like, they turn an orangutan inside out in a way that's just truly just gross and disgusting.
As opposed to all those sterile, really presentable ways to turn a baboon inside out.
Like, weren't
out.
You, like, I was, you tweeted about this the other day, or Facebooked about how you were eating in the middle of this movie.
I have to tell this story, and I don't usually do this because she doesn't like it when I talk about her on air, but my girlfriend was in the kitchen, and she was making dinner, and I had this movie on because I knew we were going to be talking about it, and then that thought hit me about 5 minutes in, like, she's making dinner, I was like, oh, crap, she's not going to want to watch this while we eat. Of course not. This is, what am I doing? And so I was like, well, I'll turn it off when dinner's ready. And she sees that I'm watching The Fly. She tells me that she loves The Fly. I'm like, yeah, probably still doesn't want to watch it while we're eating. And then dinner's ready. I go to turn it off. And she said, hey, babe, can we rewind it? Because I missed all the gross stuff. And I was just like all Twitter-pated about that. I was like, oh, this is why I love you. So we sat and ate tacos and watched all of the most horrific shit happen.
Yeah, it's
in
The Fly. Like, it's the thing is what's so great about this movie is how Cronenberg ramps up the grossness.
Yes.
He starts very silly and very small. You know, it's hairs growing out of a wound.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he's getting acne.
Yes.
His hair's getting greasy. Then his hair starts falling out and he starts getting all this bulbous stuff on his body. And then his fingernails start falling out. And his teeth start falling out. And
the specificity of the gore is what's so great about this.
And then he starts regurgitating because he can't digest food anymore. So he starts vomiting up this snot onto food to digest it and then eat it. And then it just progressively gets worse.
It gets worse from there.
Yeah. Until we get to the scene where she pulls his jaw off.
Oh.
And now Brundlefly can't talk anymore, and he begins to come apart.
Yeah.
And then he becomes the fly.
Yeah. And I like how, by the way, that vomit was made from honey, eggs, and milk. So enjoy ever trying to eat those things together. Enjoy your breakfast tomorrow, I guess.
Well, first of all, honey, eggs, and milk are three things that when you put together, I mean...
You make that... That could all be part of your
nutritious
breakfast.
That's got
to
be raw egg.
Yeah.
And so that's... Honey and raw egg and milk is going to be kind of a... I mean, it's just not going to taste particularly great anyway.
No. But if you're training like Rocky, I feel like that might be a drink that you would fashion for yourself in the morning. But yeah, one of the things I love about this movie is that all of the things we just described could have been in a way lesser movie, a movie that was more about, you know, just a splatter film that was all about the spectacle, all about giving gorehounds what they want. And it sounds low rent to describe the gross things that happen in this movie. It sounds like the movie we're describing is something almost juvenile, but that's not what this is. And that is, to me, what is so brilliant about Cronenberg.
Well, there is a movie similar in level of grossness that I was going to mention. Like I mentioned mainstream, there is one that is called, appropriately, Body Melt. It is a body horror movie from Australia that has one of the greatest poster taglines I've ever seen in my life. But it's... it is equally, it kind of touches these levels of grossness, like in terms of sickness and illness, but the story and the character isn't there. Mm-hmm. And so it's a movie that never quite reaches what this does because of how serious this takes it.
But that's obviously Body Melt's not probably not reaching the same level of mainstream success as
well. That's why I said that. Yeah. Like, but even then, like, that's the thing is Body Melt's a fun movie to watch once because it's gross.
Yeah.
You don't watch The Fly because it's gross. That's exactly the point I was going for, was that this is a movie that the fact that it's gross is a fun addition to what makes this more of a midnight movie than it does a 10 p.m. movie.
Yeah.
But it's the story and the characters that really drive this narrative. Like the fact, you know, what happens to this guy and how he deals with it. And like even the brilliance of just how simple and the cold open is to this movie,
yeah,
where we just come right in and we're in the middle of a conversation with Gina Davis, who's a reporter, and
babyface young Jeff Goldblum.
Babyface Jeff Goldblum.
Well, babyface at the beginning of the movie,
yeah,
not so much by the end of the movie.
Who is trying to impress her, who's clearly attracted to her. He's trying to impress her with his work, and she's just not buying it. Like, she's talked to too many fucking douchebags here at this convention she's at who are just trying to get in her pants and just trying to impress her, and she doesn't give a shit. And then he manages to talk her into coming back to his workshop to show her this thing he's working on. And, of course, what we find out he's working on is teleportation.
Yeah.
And the way we just get into this, like, we take off running. Like, there's no other introduction to these characters. We meet them right here. We're in it. We come in media res. We're right in the middle of it, right in the thick of it. And then we're, bam, we're off and running. And we're finding out about what he's doing and all this right from the get-go.
Which is another thing I feel like makes this feel very theatrical, because I've seen a number of plays that feel like they begin in the middle of a conversation. There's not a lot of lead-up. There's not a lot of pomp and circumstance. You're just dropped right in the middle of someone's drama. And I feel like that is another quality of this movie that makes it feel very theatrical. Is, like Cargill said, we are just right in the thick of it immediately. I mean, in any other movie like this would take a good half hour before Gina Davis is in that laboratory.
Yeah.
Not this movie.
No, it's just right off. And but what really works is that initial motivation. Like, this is literally, we're watching a scientist try to get laid.
Yeah.
Like, the opening motivation of this film is very driven by his sexual urges, which then becomes so important later in the movie. And ultimately become part of the theme of the movie and what leads to the heartbreak of the climax.
Yeah, for sure. And even Cronenberg in the commentary for this movie recognizes the theatricality of it and talks, you know, even when the Blu-ray first came out, was talking about the opera and the reason for that adaptation being the theatricality of the movie. But I want to go back for a second about us talking about how this was a movie that should not be. And I want to talk about two things specifically. One of those being that this is not only a movie that should not be, this is a movie that almost wasn't. And we talked about this before. I'm on our Raw Deal episode, we actually talked about this because we were talking about Dino De Laurentiis and about how the first time Cronenberg was offered this movie, he turned it down because he was the original director of Total Recall. So he's working on Total Recall. He turns down this movie and it goes to another director who ends up leaving the project, not because of differences with producers or anything to that effect, but because he had a family tragedy and just could not bring himself to finish the movie. And so by this time, Total Recall has fallen apart as far as Cronenberg's involvement. He cannot get along with Dino De Laurentiis. He leaves the project, comes back to The Fly. So this really was, this to me, talking about singularity of vision, without Cronenberg, without the master of body horror, without a filmmaker who is so intensely interested in the very flesh that makes us human and the things that can happen to that flesh that can rid us of our humanity, this movie is not the same. This is not the quality of film that we get. And then the other thing is, as far as movies that should not be, one of the things I feel like most people don't know about The Fly, do you know who one of its biggest producers was? Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Mel Brooks is one of this movie's, like, one of the guy behind everything, who didn't want his name to be plastered all over it because he felt like people would think it was a comedy. But Mel Brooks is a fucking producer on this movie. And not only that, but is the person who ends up recommending Cronenberg in the first place.
Yeah. And Cronenberg is so essential to this movie. The thing is I think about the fact that, you know, when this movie was made was also the beginning of Peter Jackson's career. You know, his first movie, Bad Taste, came out in 87. And I think I've occasionally thought about what his version of this movie would look like, because he was doing this kind of gross out stuff and playing with body horror at the time. Bad Taste, Meet the Feebles,
Dead Alive,
mm-hmm. AKA Brain Dead. And he was playing with gross out, but he would have made it funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, is as weird and silly as this gets at points, Cronenberg never lets you forget that it's supposed to be fucked up and scary.
And tragic.
And tragic. Like, you, when he loses a tooth the first time, you're grossed out, but at the same time, you're like, oh, fuck, this dude's falling apart.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, even the kind of laughable stuff, like the first regurgitation sequence where he's like, oh, that was gross, I'm sorry. Like, yeah. You didn't even think about it. You laugh, but it's not over the top silly. Like, it's, you're feeling that tragedy. You're feeling this guy slipping away, yeah, as his body changes. And Cronenberg just nails it. And he's, I don't know that there's another director that could have quite captured this.
Yeah.
It really is the essence of who Cronenberg was as a director, and how his singular vision could not really have been replicated by anyone else that wasn't directly replicating this. Like, I don't know if you hand the script of The Fly to any other director, you get a film that comes close to being this.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that entirely. And I think the comedy in this movie, even the comedy in this movie is tragically ironic, because the scene you just mentioned where he regurgitates and it should just be gross and weird and kind of freaky is funny because of Jeff Goldblum's performance. Throughout this whole movie, Seth Brundle refuses to let himself grasp the severity of his situation. He is always making light of it all the way up to the end.
Everything about you is changing. You look bad. You smell bad.
I've never been much of a bather.
He's got such a cavalier attitude about the whole thing because he still feels like he's on the verge of something great. And that's the ironic tragedy of it, is that he's able to kind of keep his chin up while he has a chin because he still thinks that he is in pursuit of... This fucking movie is Icarus. This is like yet another example of Icarus flying too close to the sun and paying for it. And in this case, Icarus just happens to be hilariously awkward Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. Brundlefly.
Brundlefly.
It's it is such a great narrative. And it's, you know, a very classic story that works its way up to a deeply fucked up climax.
Yes.
That's the thing, is that the climax to this movie is so simple. Like, the parts of it, the mechanical parts of it, are very simple. But the elegance of how the gore unravels and how Jeff Goldblum unravels and the, you know, what he does to the other characters in this final scene as he's trying to merge his DNA with someone else to clean out the fly DNA so he can be more man than fly,
mm-hmm,
it's horrifying. Like, he's willing to kill another human being or merge with another human being in order to save himself. And then in doing so, like, melts a guy.
Yeah.
Like, just fucking takes off his hand and leg. And then ultimately turns himself into such a fucked up thing that ultimately he's begging to be killed at the end. You know, this, yeah, final kill me moment is, and it's so... You want to see him dead at that point. You know he's gone over the bend. You know he has to be destroyed. And at the same time, you feel nothing but compassion for him in that final moment.
Yeah.
Like, even though you've just watched him do all these fucked up things, you are just, your heart's broken for him.
Yeah.
And it's just dark and fucked up in all the right ways. In all the ways, it's, I believe this is Cronenberg's best film.
I would 100% agree with that. 100%. And one of the things I think is so, just from a story perspective about this, is so heartbreaking, is that the person, this is not a Frankenstein's monster situation, because the personal stakes are upped so much because the monster is Frankenstein. He allows himself to become the monster, even though that wasn't his intention. you know, Frankenstein is his own monster in this movie. And I feel like there's so many deeper things that they are examining here that, again, if you get distracted by the gore and the special effects, which, by the way, garnered an Oscar.
Like
if the first credit, what I love about this, the first credit that hits as soon as the movie is over is not director, it's not actor, it is Chris Wallace, who did all of the Fly special effects. And apparently they did that specifically so that he would get his due. And one of the producers leaned over to him at a screening when that title card came up and said, "You just won an Oscar." And he was right. Just immediately won that Oscar for best special effects. But the themes that this movie is dealing with, are some of them are intentional. Some of them are things that people have kind of projected onto it but still work. Like one of my favorite, much like The Thing, one of my favorite subtexts to this movie, real or imagined, is that this, I mean, you have to remember, this movie came out in the mid-80s at the height of the AIDS crisis. There is a lot of subtext to this movie that could be perceived as being AIDS subtext. And I think that's really fascinating, especially when you get to the part of the movie about, you know, the way it's perceived that when he goes to the bar and is trying to pick up a woman and whether or not to keep the baby and like all these things that and like his physical deterioration. And you start thinking about all of these things in the context, in the light of the AIDS crisis, and just becomes even deeper and even darker. Yeah. And even if Cronenberg himself has said that he didn't think of that, he just kind of saw this as a metaphor for disease in general and how certain diseases can, you know, completely take our humanity away from us. But I still think it's an interesting approach to this film, to the analyzing of this film. And then, of course, the whole idea of, for me, what I think is an interesting theme is the idea that if you knew that there was going to be something wrong with your child, the idea of keeping it because it's your child, or aborting it because there's going to be something genetically wrong with it.
Well, and that's something that keeps coming up in conversation, you know, in politics, and is we are on there's been a number of speculative fiction about this, about, you know, the genetic, you know, alteration of a child and what it would mean, you know, if we allow essentially eugenics to take place through the course of genetic alteration and aborting children that aren't perfect. But this is that terrible question that, you know, people get asked, which is, what if you found out your child was going to be severely handicapped, almost non-functioning, or a Brundlefly, Brundlefly or Jr. Brundlefly. Would you keep it? Would you, you know, or would you terminate that, knowing full well that it is effectively the end of two lives? Like it is, you know, it's a hard choice to wrestle with. And she wrestles with this, and that becomes the major driving force of that third act. As he's breaking down physically, she's breaking down mentally.
Right.
As she disintegrates through the transformation and through dealing with her own problem. And it's so weird, this scene, you know, 30 years away, which occurred, you know, we're talking, this is a movie that took place 14 years after Roe v. Wade, where it's still not entirely accessible and publicly accepted on all fronts, to where, you know, he's like, I know someone who can take care of this. Like, it's not I'll just go down to the clinic and get this done. She's talking to this guy who's like, no, I know somebody. We can take care of this. As if it's still not readily available where she is. And that's a very weird kind of historical artifact to this. And it really kind of highlights what a tough and terrible decision she has. Like, she loves this guy and wants to keep the baby, but is terrified of what Brundlefly Jr. will be. She, you know, which Eric Stoltz is going to come out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which Eric Stoltz. By the way,
Is it going to be Mask Eric Stoltz?
Am I the only one that kind of likes The Fly 2?
Like, kind of likes. I like The Fly 2.
I like The Fly 2 quite a bit, and I feel like it doesn't get... it gets like
it's not completely it's nearly not as no. good as no. The Fly. And whenever you have a sequel to a classic movie and it's not as good, it's going to, you know, pale in comparison over the years. And I remember it was considered something of a little disappointment at the time, but I always liked it.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, I have not watched it super recently, so I'd be curious to see how it holds up for me.
Yeah, I saw it at a Terror Tuesday at some point and just really dug it. Ended up going out and finding the DVD. And one of the interesting things is that there was a more official Fly sequel in development, where it, the more I started like reading about it, felt like some weird connection to like, what was that? It was the movie where Johnny Depp like fuses with technology. It came out
Transcendence.
Yeah, because the whole idea was that Brundle's consciousness was kept alive in machinery, and he was basically being used by the government to further cloning research. And then like somebody helps him basically use technology to lash out at people, and so that was interesting. There was also a sequel later, but in that sequel that I just mentioned, like Goldblum was going to have a cameo. Gina Davis was going to be in it again. It was a lot of people were going to come back for it. That kind of fell apart. And then Gina Davis was even supposed to be in The Fly 2, but in the original script, they killed her character off immediately, and she didn't like that, so she left. And then there was another idea for a sequel to be directed by her then-husband, Rennie Harlan, called Flies, which I immediately hoped was like, if the first one's called The Fly and this one's called Flies, I hope it's like an Aliens situation.
That's got to be what it is. I mean, that's where they came up with Flies, I guarantee you.
It apparently, the story had to do with she had twins and it was about the two kids. So that's why the plural. But I was like, oh, come on. If you're going to call it Flies, send in some Colonial Marines to deal with.
Just send in a group of Marines into an old
warehouse.
Brundle Industries. Brundle Industries labs.
Yeah.
And it's all of, you know, the offspring have cloned themselves, or and so now there's all these flies running around.
They've been doing experiments where they keep blending things together, where like they're doing all of these crossover experiments, and then they have to fight all these like hybrid monsters. We could have an actual man bear pig.
Why would you want a man bear pig? Why wouldn't you just want to go to the source and go straight to the well and make the Prophecy Bear?
Oh, Prophecy Bear. And then you could have a crossover where an Italian plays
or
a Native
Grizzly
American.
Or Grizzly 2.
You could put Armando Sante in the pod with an actual Native American so that what comes out is the Native American he plays in Prophecy, which somehow is an Italian guy. But, yeah, I got way off track with that. Just, like, so far off track.
Just like a normal episode of Junk like Food Cinema.
And I think what makes this movie for me is just the how manic Jeff Goldblum is. And I know that's kind of easy to say because he's sort of that way in everything.
Jeff Goldblum
finds a way. But he starts off awkward in a way that's very charming. And then the first time he goes through the pod is infused with all of this vigor and just it goes a mile a minute.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Starts doing gymnastics in the living room and becomes addicted to the feeling that it gave him, not realizing that he's in the first stages of complete genetic deterioration. And it's, you know, then you've got kind of a drug addiction subtext to it as well. So there's just all of these things that make you like this guy, and then there are all these things that make your heart break for this guy. And I think one of the smartest things they do in the movie, and something that they actually cut from the original cut of the movie, is that you never see him kill anyone.
No.
He doesn't kill anyone in this movie. Like, by the time we get to the end, he severely fucks up Stannis Baratheon, who I'm just going to call Stannis Baratheon now. Like, severely fucks that guy up. There is no question about that. But in the original cut of the movie, he also like makes a cat baboon hybrid that he then beats to death when he sees what he's created. And then there's another scene that was cut where he kills like a homeless lady and like literally melts her face and eats her. And I feel like it was really smart to cut those things out, because what that allows is that from start to finish, you want this guy to get help. He clearly needs help. He clearly can't see that what he's doing is dangerous. He can't see how bad it's getting until it's too late, but you still feel for the guy. your heart still, especially when he learned that there's that amazing scene where he finds out that Gina Davis is about to have an abortion, and he tracks down the doctor and like takes her out of there, not even in a fury, but just in a like, please don't destroy the last thing of me that is going to exist in this world. Like, it, you want to cry. Like, you're this guy who's wearing 5 pounds of prosthetics and looks like something you burnt when you were trying to make breakfast is making you want to cry just because of the emotional implications and the performance. And that's what's, to me, is so brilliant about this film, is the whole time you're watching this gross out graphic horror movie, you still feel something very sincere. And that is such a hard thing to pull off.
Yeah, no, it is. It is a genuine masterpiece, cinema. And I think that if it wasn't so gross, I think if it wasn't so over the top in terms of just how disgusting it gets, it would be a much more mainstream film. It would be something that was watched and talked about much more often because of just how good it is. But yeah, it is just one of those things that so many people can only watch once.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Not us.
I will watch this movie over and over and over again. And I want to say one more thing about Chris Wallace, who is a fucking genius of practical effects. The scene where Stannis Baratheon gets his hand melted.
I love that that's what we're calling
him. Yeah, that's just what I'm calling him now. Where he gets his hand melted, it's a very different effect. You can tell it just looks, it's executed differently than any other effect in the movie, but something was very familiar about it, and it was driving me crazy until I found out that Chris Wallace also worked on a little film called Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, it's
just a little
the
film.
Fucking face melt. It's the same technique as of the face melt in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they literally crafted it out of a gelatin and then superheated it and filmed it actually melting. I was like, I knew it looked familiar, but it was driving me crazy. I'm like, why do I feel like I've seen this exact type of melting before? And sure enough, it's because Chris Wallace has worked on a lot of amazing films and is a fucking, like, I don't even know. He's a genius, and I love watching all. That's what's amazing, is you can't look away from what you really want to look away from in this movie. You don't want to look at it, but you really do, because it's done so well. And so, and I love that, you know, I can't even imagine trying to do this movie again now, because I feel like any studio is going to mandate, you know, just for the bottom line, everything done with computers. And I just feel like that would remove so much of the texture from it.
This is one of those films that really should not be remade again. Like, it was a remake in and of itself.
Sure.
But it was improving on a film that hadn't quite achieved perfection. And this achieved perfection what it did. Mm-hmm. And the practical effects here aren't dated.
No.
Like, they're so good. The effects in this movie are exactly what they need to be, and you're not going to improve upon them. I mean, no. Maybe, you know, techniques have changed, and there's great people doing practical effects today, but you'd essentially get a couple of different performances from people, from a couple of, you know, modern actors, and then get different gore. Mm. And it's just at that point, it's just going to see how they handle the gore and what the fly looks like this time around. And that's not, it's not a reason to see a movie. There's not any story choices here that they left on the table that you're like, you know what would have been really cool? Mm-hmm. Like, if they'd done this. Like, no. The fact that the movie's 30 years old, if, you know, people don't like The Fly 2, you could make The Fly 3 and have it be, you know, 30 years later with Brundle Fly Jr., you know.
Sure.
I mean, that's the one thing you could do if you do it, but this is not a movie that needs to be touched.
No.
Because it's just, it has done what it needs to do, unless there's somebody out there who does have that perfect, like, I know where this story needed to go that it didn't. But the thing is that we've seen so many iterations of this, in one way, shape, or form. We saw a similar one with the movie Splice.
Several years back.
That was very much The Fly. Like, this is such a simple story, and it's a story that is borrowed very heavily from other works, that making a variant on this story is fully acceptable.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that a lot of that stems from the fact that we're talking about this movie that, in a lot of ways, now it did use it only as a jumping off point and made several alterations. But we're talking about a film that is ostensibly based on a short story published in a Playboy magazine in 1957. So, I mean, these themes, these ideas had been gestating for a while. So, I mean, obviously, variations upon it, you know, taking that idea. And I mean, people have already done that. And even sometimes, you know, doing it in a way that we don't even recognize it immediately as doing that, because it is such a classic sci-fi idea. And what I mean by that is, what I think is great about classic sci-fi of the 50s is a lot of times it is playing upon the same fears as the mad scientist movies of the Universal age, a Universal era of monster movies, which is just the idea that, you know, when our reach exceeds our grasp and when we get too curious and when we try to, you know, sometimes there's another side to that whole Star Trek New Frontier kind of science fiction where sometimes trying to break new ground is a violent, dangerous, scary prospect.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, it, you know, ethics in science is, you know, a very fertile ground for this kind of storytelling and for just imagination. You know, there's a, you know, one of my favorite things of recent years is a bunch of people talking about becoming Martian settlers. Mm-hmm. That the idea that, hey, what if we went to Mars? We know that it's going to Mars right now. We don't have the technology to get back. So what if we don't come back? What if we just shoot people at Mars and let them live there as long as they can and try to figure it out? Like, what if we do that? Like, that's kind of horrible. That's kind of awful.
Yeah.
Let's blast, you know, a couple dozen people to, you know, a frozen rock 60 million miles away. But at the same time, it's, you know, that's how we would make those discoveries. So it's always interesting to watch these stories where you have these scientists who, like Frankenstein, is trying to reanimate dead tissue because it could mean we could live forever. It means, you know, a whole host of life-saving procedures. But it does involve making a monster to start off with. You know, you have this movie where it's like, I'm trying to achieve teleportation, but at the same time, I've achieved genetic splicing. Like, what else can I do with this? Like, these are real interesting questions and great storytelling jumping off points.
Yeah, and I think that's why, and I think Seth Brundle is such a great mouthpiece for that idea. I mean, during the movie, he quotes Alexander Pope's essay on criticism. He says, you know, drink deep or taste not, which is, the full quote being, a little learning is a dangerous thing, drink deep or taste not, the Pierian spring. So he's a guy who believes to the very end, to literally his last moment, that what he's doing, the pursuit of that knowledge, the pursuit of that advancement, he's bettering humanity, he is doing something great. Even at the moments where he's really just trying to better himself, he is still just relentlessly focused on trying to achieve, on trying to break that new ground, on drinking deep from that spring, and that in the end becomes his downfall. And that's the real tragedy of this movie, is that he's not a guy that really did anything wrong. He is a guy who, through no, like, literally a fly on the wall that he wasn't even aware of completely destroys him. There's nothing, his biggest crime in this movie is trying to do something no one else had done before. And he pays for it so dearly that I think that's where
his
a lot of
his biggest crime early in the movie.
Yeah.
Because by the time he regurgitates on Stannith Baratheon and like melts his hand and his foot off, that's probably the worst crime.
Yeah, I think there's a
trying
case to
gene
be made
splice, you know, somebody to effectively murder them, but not really murder them, but murder them also is a pretty bad crime.
Breaking
a guy's wrist, you know, while arm wrestling
during the arm wrestling scene,
during the over the top scene,
during the great over the top scene featuring a former Canadian heavyweight boxing champion who had fought Muhammad Ali. Like, it's just, this movie is phenomenal in so many ways. And another, just one last thing of the movie that almost wasn't, Chris Wallace had to make a decision. Between working on, and his crew had to make a decision between working on this and working on Gremlins 2, The New Batch, because that movie was going to require 3 years of prep, or they could do this movie immediately, and they all agreed to do this movie. So this movie almost. So Dino De Laurentiis and Joe Dante almost robbed us of this movie. Almost inadvertently robbed us of David Cronenberg's The Fly. And I feel like that's an even bigger crime than regurgitating acid onto someone's limbs. Again, I don't really know ethics.
I'll take that.
But I'll take that.
That's disgusting.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God, yes.
Oh, God. We should let's just skip the junk food pairing this week.
Here's the best
junk
part.
Junk food pairing
is nothing.
Not this week. So, bye, everybody. Have a good week. Bye.
That is so great that you and I are on the same page here, because at first I was like, I am recommending not eating a goddamn thing while watching this movie. And then I thought about it a little more, and I was like, no.
It's going to be like chili dogs.
No, no.
It? Like melty cheese chili dogs.
I want you to go out and buy like 15 candy bars. And I want you to make yourself a cup of cappuccino and get about 15 sugar cubes and drop them all in there while you are frantically quoting scientists and artists alike in your pursuit of all things groundbreaking in science. This the greatest part about this is I wrestled with these two things, and I thought, so the choices here are eat everything or eat nothing. Everything or nothing, very much the way Seth Brundle's science works. It's like either we are literally breaking the barriers of metaphysics, or we are destroying ourselves entirely. Everything or nothing is kind of how Seth Brundle as a scientist lives. So I'm going to leave it up to you. If you have a strong constitution, throughout the movie, Brundle...
In other words, if you're an American...
If you're an American, you eat those 15 fucking candy bars. Like Seth, that's one of my favorite things.
We have the best constitution.
The best constitution. He eats more candy bars in this movie than Brad Pitt eats in the whole Ocean's trilogy. It is just crazy. It's one of the Fly attributes. I hope you were the groom. He starts craving sugar so much that he's like the great scene where he's just mindlessly almost dumping sugar into his cappuccino, and she's like, "Do you usually like a little coffee with your sugar?" Because again, he's turning into a fly.
I'll have the cannoli.
Waiter, for God's sake, wait! I love that he ad-libbed extra lines to a speech that is already relentless. Like, that is just, the words per minute of that speech are mind-boggling, and then he added more to it because he's Jeff Goldblum. Well, that's going to do it for our episode on The Fly. If you haven't seen this movie, what are you waiting for? What, seriously, guys, you need to go check this movie out immediately.
This is one of the required junk food classics. This is the Junk Food Hall of Fame material. Like, this is literally one of those great genre masterpieces.
There are some David Cronenberg movies that have Criterion releases. Is The Fly one of them? I don't believe it is. I don't believe The Fly has a Criterion release. And if it does not, hear me, Criterion Collection. Hear me now and remember me for the rest
of your life. Hear me now and believe me later.
Hear me now and get to the job up. Put out a Criterion Collection release of The Fly, because it is a movie that fucking deserves it. The cinema.
I don't know. Does it need it though? Hasn't The Fly pretty much always been in print in some way, shape, or form?
It has, but that's not always the criteria for the Criterion Collection. Like, they released almost all of Wes Anderson's movies, pretty much as soon as they come out. Those are not hard to get your hands on either.
Hey, look, it's out on DVD. It's a Criterion.
They pretty much start stamping it before the movie's even in theaters. So I don't think that's necessarily the criteria. But I just think this is a movie that is so exquisitely shot. The sound design, the special effects, the performances, the directing, everything about this movie is straight up auteur. It is next level, and it doesn't get as much respect as I think it should from the mainstream, because a lot of people just remember the gore effects. And I feel like this movie is so much more than that, and I feel like if it had a Criterion release, if The Rock can have a Criterion release, The Fly should have a Criterion release.
Well, yeah, that's all. Armageddon.
Armageddon
release is kind of amazing.
That's true.
Director's cut.
If you would like to hear us wax more about the movies that we love that we think should or should not be part of the Criterion Collection, you can look at our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs? I don't know why I went full Dukes of Hazzard
like
on that.
West Texas on us.
Well,
I play for Permian Odessa. Friday Night Lights.
Fixing to get me some more podcasts at the Getting Place.
Yeah, well, you can find me on the Twitters over there at @ Massa Worm. That's MASSAWYRM.
Now, is that one of them?
Or on the Facebooks over there on that their Facebook page. Also, Facebook.com/MASHWORM.
So now that at symbol, is that one of them little A's what's doing cartwheels?
It's the A with the big penis hanging around that it's slung over its shoulder.
Big old swinging dick.
Big old swinging dick.
Yeah, of course.
On that at sign. Big old, you know, so, you know, big old swinging dick, Massa Worm.
You know, that line that these accents won't get us in trouble, but it'll do till trouble gets here. I'm sorry, I just watched No Country for Old Men today. So I think that's that why this is coming
out. I think that's
out.
Where you picked up your accents.
Oh my God, I just realized that's probably where it's coming out. Anyway, you can find me in my normal voice that you can't hear because it's social media at Bry Guy Salisbury on Twitter or my Facebook page, facebook.com/ Brian Salisbury Critic.
Oh, hey. Actually, quick aside. Actually, this week you can find me over on Rage Select.
Oh, there you go.
I was on Rage Select. I wrote a screenplay for an adaptation of the video game Deus Ex, and the new Deus Ex Mankind Divided came out today.
There you go.
And so I recorded a couple episodes with Professor Jeff. So head on over to Rage Select if you need a little more Cargill in your life.
That's scary. That's almost as scary as putting 30 cubes of sugar in your cappuccino. But we actually did have someone suggest to us at some point that there's a movie we should cover on the show, and if we do, we should have Professor Jeff on. I'm blanking on the name of the movie.
Is it Gamer?
No, it was Transformers, since it's 1986. The Transformers movie, they said if we end up doing that, we should have Professor
Jeff
on.
That was one of those on our short list, by the way. Transformers 1986
have
is,
to see about
is pretty spectacular.
That but guys, thank you so much for joining us. And as always, we want to remind you to be afraid. Be very afraid.